Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Tetzayin Amud Aleph by the two dots. Ko shelo naseit b'chol elu. The Mishnah says anything that doesn't seemingly have all of these protocols associated with it does not gain or attain the kedusha of Yer Yerushalayim or kedushat Hazara vis-a-vis the Beit HaMikdash. Here we have a machloket amoraim itmar. Ravuna amar b'chol elu tznan. He says the Mishnah reads b'chol elu, literally. You need all of these items. You don't have all of these items, you're not mekadesh the area. Rav Nachman amar b'chat mikol elu tnan. It is one of these items, not all of these items. If you think back to the Gemara in Makot, we also had sukim like this in which the Tanaim argued about this issue or discussed this issue, which is al titamu b'chol elu, someone who it becomes tamei from any one of these items. And there, the psukim are speaking about all the different types of lichisha, machashefa, all those alternative powers. And there, the Torah seems to indicate that if you violate all of them, then you are chayav. And the interpretation of the Tanaim doesn't mean hametamei b'chol eile, ela means achat mikol eile, one of these, any one of these items. And so too, Rav Nachman is interpreting the Mishnah in that same vein or in that same manner. Their machloki could be about Lashon HaMikra versus Lashon HaMishnah. In the Mikra and the Psukim, we find that the word kol can mean either all, or kol can also mean any of the above. And the question is, in the Mishnah, when it uses that term kol, does it mean only all of the above? Or is he using it in the same vein that he would use it in a Pasuk, which means any of the above? Rav Nachman clearly believes achat mikol elu, and Rav Huna believes that you need b'chol elu. That will have impact in terms of bayit sheni, because we know in the Gemara in Yoma that it tells us that there were certain items that they didn't have in bayit sheni. There are two items in particular out of the list in the Mishnah, one of which is pretty straightforward, is melech. There was no king. We came under the auspices of the Persians when we returned in bayit sheni. The king was the king of Persia, not a Jewish king. There was no autonomy at that time. So you're missing Melech. The other thing that we're missing is Urim Vitumim, and that is enumerated in that list in Yoma of the differences between Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni, that they didn't have Urim Vitumim. So you have the absence of a Melech and Urim Vitumim in Bayit Sheni, which would then make it impossible to accomplish all the items that are listed in our Mishnah. So if you believe you need B'chol Elu, then there's no way you could be Mekadesh, the city, or the Azara in Bayit Sheni. If you believe you need one of those, then of course you could do it still in Bayit Sheni. Rashi says on the previous Amud, with regards to this opinion, Achat Mikol Elu means any one of these items. O Melech, O Kohen Gadol, O Navi, O Sanhedrin, O Shtei Todot. So you can have any one of these items. Many Achronim indicate that that is not the case. It's not a anything goes, or any one of these is fine. That's not that any one of these is fine. Everybody seems to agree that you need the korbanot. You need the shtei todot, you need the sheri amincha. The only question is about the other items, the melech, the sanhedrin, the navi, whether those are an absolute requirement. But the korbanot seemingly are integral to the ability to create that kedusha because they are the ones that delineate where, up to where you can eat these items, and beyond which you cannot eat these items. Narvuna Amar B'chol Elu Tznan, he says that all of these items are required, as the Mishnah says, Kasavar, he must hold, Kedusha Rishona Kitsha Deshata, Kitsha Datid Davo, that the original Kedusha imbued in, we'll say for now, Eretz Yisrael, and in Yerushalayim, at the time of Yeshua Bin Nun, and then later at the time of David and Shlomo, was a permanent Kedusha, and that kedusha remains even into the time of Bayit Sheni. That's why you don't need to re-sanctify the area in the time of Bayit Sheni because of the fact that it was already kadosh from the original time. Ve'ezra zecher ba'amahu da'avad. Wait a minute, but we do have a description in Ezra about what they did, or how they carried out the sanctification in that time of Bayit Sheni. So then why did they do all of that if it wasn't necessary? The answer is that Ezra did it zecher ba'alma. He did it just as a remembrance as to what the original Kedusha was like, or how they installed the original Kedusha, but it was exactly that, ceremonial in nature. It was not something by which they really were Mekadesh the area. So that's the view of Rav Huna, that the Kedusha, or the reason that you were able to build the Beit HaMikdash and reinstate Yerushalayim as a city, is because of the original Kedusha, and not because of the... And not because of what they did at that time. So Rav Nachman, who says you can use any one of these items in order to sanctify the area, he believes the first Kedusha was not permanent. And therefore what Ezra was doing was literally sanctifying the city and sanctifying the Mikdash. Despite the fact that they were missing the Urim V'Tumim, and as we noted before, also the Melech is missing from that list. And so what they did was, they actually were sanctifying it, even though they didn't have the ability to do all the items that are listed in our Mishnah. And that's because the first Kedusha was not permanent. Tosfot over here asks a question and leaves it as a Tzarechiyun. He says, why are we so desperate to set up this Mishnah in a way that can be understood that you were successful at creating Kedusha in the time of Bayit Sheni? He says we have a list of many Mishnayot, starting in the first parak in Megillah. We have it in Zvachim. We have it in other places where there are Tanaim that clearly believe that Kedusha Rishona was not permanent, or that the Kedusha Rishona was permanent. So, if that's the case, why do we have to force this Mishnah to be able to be read by the opinion that believes that the Kedusha Rishona was not permanent? Just say our Tana believes that the Kedusha Rishona was permanent. Other Tanaim disagree, and you can subscribe to those other Tanaim. Why do we have what Rav Nachman is suggesting over here, which is the meaning of the Mishnah means not all of these items, but rather one of these items, in order that it can fit into the fact that Kedusha Rishona was not permanent. So Tosafot leaves that as a Tzarechiyun as to why the Gemara is compelled to explain the Mishnah in that manner. It seems that Rav Nachman was trying to not only explain our Mishnah, but also explain the Psukim in Sefer Nehemiah. And so that's what may be driving force here, which is not just to explain our Mishnah, but also to explain what they were doing. Were they really creating Kedusha? Did they have the capacity to create Kedusha? And that might be the reason that Rav Nachman's going that direction. Again, even though there are other Tanaim in other places where he could have hung his hat on, nevertheless, he's trying to make this Mishnah fit that opinion as well. Eitvei Rav of Nachman, Kol Shalom Nasit B'chol Eilu. So Rav asked Rav Nachman, our Mishnah says, Kol Shalom Nasit B'chol Eilu, anything that was not done with all of these protocols, then it doesn't have Tosefet Kedusha. So today, V'chat Mikol Eilu. Just amend the Mishnah to read, not a but rather, and that'll solve the problem. So yes, the language of the Mishnah seems to favor Rav Huna. But nevertheless, Rav Nachman says, you're reading it in a way that says kol means everything, it really means achat mikol elu. Tashma, Abba Shaul omer, shnei bitzim ayu bahara mishka. So here's a Tosefta from Sanhedrin. This Tosefta speaks about areas of Yerushalayim. There were two marshy areas. The word bitza is an area that has water, grass in it. Rashi actually brings from this week's parsha that the parot that come out, v'tir'ena ba'achu, that they were ro'im, they were grazing ba'achu in the marsh or in the areas where there was water and reed grass. So that's the reference in this week's parsha, but it's a reference to an area of Yerushalayim that seemingly was either good grazing ground, had water, some low, shallow water in that area. They were on Bahara Mishcha. Har Mishcha is reference to Har HaZeitim. Tachtona ve'el Yona. One was lower down, one was higher up. Remember, Har HaZeitim is a mountain, so we're speaking on the slope of the mountain. One of them was lower on the slope, and one of them was higher on the slope of the mountain. Tachtona nitkatsha b'kol eilu. The lower one was sanctified with all of the protocols that were said before, meaning it was already sanctified from the time of Bayit Rishon. El Yona lo nitkatsha b'chol eilu. The upper one, the one that was closer to the top of Har HaZeitim, did not have the sanctification with all of these. Ela bole gola. People who returned from the exile, they sanctified it. Shelo b'melech v'shelo b'urim v'tumim. This is what we noted before. The two things that were missing in Bayit Sheni are the king and the urim v'tumim. Tachtona shaita kedushata gimura. The lower one, which has full-fledged sanctification, because it was done with all the protocol that is mentioned in our Mishnah. Amei haaretz nichnasim l'sham. The Amei haaretz go there ve'ochlim sham kochim kalim. They eat kochim kalim there. Avalo ma'asir sheni. But they don't eat ma'asir sheni over there. Ve'chaverim, and those that are well-versed or follow the ways of the chachamim, ochlim sham kochim kalim u'ma'asir sheni. They eat both items over there, both the kochim kalim and the ma'asir sheni. El Yonah, shelo hayta kedushata gemura. The upper one where was not a full-fledged kedusha because it didn't have all the protocol. They would eat the kochim kalim over there, avalo ma'aser sheni, but not ma'aser sheni. Vechaverim, again, those that are more punctilious or follow the ways of the chachamim, in oklim sham lo kochim kalim, velo ma'aser sheni. Umipnei ma lo kitshuha. Why is it that it wasn't sanctified? Mipnei she'ein mosifim ala ir ve'ala zarot ela b'melech. Very similar to our Mishnah. The only way to expand the city, to add on to the Dusha city, is with all these items. The king, the Navi, the prophet, the Urim V'Tumim, the Sanhedrin Shalayin Aleph, the Supreme Court, Sanhedrin Agdola, and the Korbanot, the Shtei Todot, and the Shir, all of which are mentioned in our Mishnah. So, V'lama Kitshua. So then why did they sanctify it? Lama Kitshua? Haramat lo kitshua. What do you mean? Why did they sanctify it? We just said you they were not successful at sanctifying it. So they didn't sanctify it. It wasn't kadosh. Ela lama hichnisua. So then why did they include it into this city? You could have a lot of problems by including this area in the city when it clearly does not have kedushat Yerushalayim. It's a michshol. It's a stumbling block, a problem for people. They're going to think it's incorporated in the city, yet it doesn't have the kedushat of the city. Mipnei shetorfa sheYerushalayim haita. Because it was a weak spot for Yerushalayim, misham, and it was easy to conquer it from there. It was a weakened spot where the enemy could breach the city or enter into the city, so they wanted to stop that. They did that by extending the wall outward and giving themselves more protection or easier protection of the city. It's interesting only because the weak point for Yerushalayim is not on the eastern side, it's on the northern side. You can go today and see that with regards to the Beit HaMikdash. With regards to the Beit HaMikdash, there are walls and valleys on all sides of the Beit HaMikdash. That is true on the southern side, that is true on the eastern side, the western side, but the northern side is level. And that's why if you walk towards the northern side, which is if you go through the Kotel tunnels and you come out the other end, you're climbing the entire time because the bedrock is rising. And when you get to the other side, on the northern side, you're basically level with Har HaBayit. If you walk through Shar HaRayot and enter into Yerushalayim from that side, if you peer down those alleyways towards Har HaBayit, you are level with Har HaBayit on that side. And that was the northern end of Yerushalayim. And that was the weakest point. Anybody who attacked Yerushalayim always attacked from the northern side because you didn't have to go through a big valley then. You didn't have to climb up to get in there. You were level with Yerushalayim. So over here, when it says that it was a weak point on the eastern side, it probably means on the northeastern side was the weak point, because again, towards the north is where you have that issue. It could be also that Har Mishkar HaZeitim became more integral. Today we think of Yerushalayim, or the old city of Yerushalayim, as the Beit HaMikdash, and then the areas that are in the Jewish quarter. The Jewish quarter was actually the newer area of Yerushalayim. Ir David, which is down below, is the original city of Yerushalayim. So in the time of Bayit Rishon, the expansion of the city towards the upper part was a much later addition. The main area of Yerushalayim was Ir David, which was below the Beit HaMikdash. It was towards the eastern side of the Beit HaMikdash. And that went down towards Silwan, where the Mayanot are and the water source is, and that's what they buried in with Chizkiyahu's tunnel to bring the water inside the city. So that area might need the protection. There you're going down towards the valley for Ir David, and that exposes you to the heights of Har HaZeitim, and maybe that's what they're referencing over here. They expanded the wall on Har HaZeitim in order to protect Ir David and the lower city or the older parts of Yerushalayim. That's one issue. That explains why they expanded the city. It was an issue of defense. It was an issue of military significance or strategic importance. And that's why they expanded the city. Rava brings it as a question of Nachman is because the Septa clearly says you can only be Mekadesh Yerushalayim with all the items mentioned in our Mishnah, not with one of the items mentioned in our Mishnah. The last thing is, what was the difference in the practice of the Ami Aretz? The Chaverim, those that understood what was happening, their minhag was pretty straightforward. In the area that was closer in towards the Beit HaMikdash, the Tachtona, which was already sanctified at the time of Beit Rishon, there they ate Kodshim Kalim and they ate Maaser Sheni. It's very easy to understand what they were doing. That area was Kadosh. The area El Yonah, further up Har HaZeitim, further away from Yerushalayim, which was not sanctified in Beit Rishon, only in Beit Sheni, there they didn't eat Kodshim Kalim and they didn't eat Maaser Sheni. So their practice is very straightforward. The more problematic practice is that of the Amei Aretz. And the Amei Aretz and the Girsa that we have in our Gemara is the Girsa of Rashi, which is the Girsa of the Tosefta, which is why Rashi favors that Girsa, as well as the fact that it's more significant to tell you the information based on the way it's structured here, which is that the Amei Aretz did something interesting both in the Tachtona and in the Aloyona. And that is because in the Tachtona, which was fully Kadosh, they would eat there, Kodshim Kalim, Avalo Maaser Sheni. They would not eat Maaser Sheni. As in the Oyuna, which was not full Kedusha, they would eat Kodshim Kalim, Avalo Maaser Sheni. In both places, they ate the Kodshim Kalim and not Maaser Sheni. Now Rashi explains what their practice was. V'yesh tefereish, dame aretz, hamafrishim masrot, ha'yuz rizim lasopo mitzvah min ha'mukhar. That Amei Aretz, who were not all scrupulous about taking care of Tumot and Masrot, we know that based on the Gemara and other places, they sent out throughout Eretz Yisrael to find out what the practice was. They found out that Rov Amei Aretz take off Tumot. And the truth is that even a significant minority take off Tumot and Masrot, but there is a big enough minority or a small majority that did not take off Masrot. That's why they instituted Demai, because we were afraid that the produce purchased from the Amei Aretz came from individuals who were not scrupulous in these issues, and therefore, for very little loss, a person could accomplish separating out all the Tumot and Masrot, mi safek. And then, in terms of those that did practice it, who did keep the mitzvah, if they're already going through the trouble of doing the mitzvah, they used to do it properly. The fee, shayu shomim drasha aser bishvil shutit aser. The reason that they were so scrupulous about it, or they were so careful, was because they used to hear the drashot of aser taser, the drush of chazal, that aser, take off masrot, kadesh titasher, so that you should become wealthy. And after sue the vidui maser, asiti kosher tzivitani, and we did exactly what you told me. So they were scrupulous in this mitzvah, because they saw it as being a skula to becoming wealthy or rich, and so they practiced it in a very careful manner. For that reason, they used to go all the way into Yerushalayim. They didn't take any risk with regards to eating Maaser Sheni. They only ate Maaser Sheni in what was absolutely certainly Yerushalayim. When it came to Kodshim, they weren't so careful about that. It didn't really matter. They would eat it anywhere within the walls of Yerushalayim, even the outer walls of Yerushalayim, when they didn't find any place to stay more internally. If they couldn't find a motel or a hotel inside the inner part of Yerushalayim, then they'd just go to that outer section. And if you tell them that place is not Kadosh, and this place is Kadosh, they would not listen to you. They say, here's a wall, and here's a wall. Both of them are included in Yerushalayim. Why should I have any differentiation? So, but Maaser Sheni, where they felt it was a skula, they wanted to do it to the utmost and ensure that they got the bracha of aser kadesh titasher. But Kodshim Kalim, where there's no such bracha, and it was a matter maybe of convenience and money that they were able to stay in the outer edges of Yerushalayim rather than internally in Yerushalayim, there they opted to say that the outer part is kadosh b'kedushat Yerushalayim. So for that reason, they didn't eat Maaser Sheni in either of these two places, because they wanted to eat it internally, absolutely certain that it was Yerushalayim. And they did eat Kodshim Kalim in both of these places because they weren't so scrupulous about that mitzvah. So that's how Rashi explains the behavior of the Amei Aretz, which seems to be strange, that they're more makbid on Maaser Sheni than they are on Kodshim Kalim. And that's what Rashi explains to you. It was about money. And when it comes to money in Sekulot, people are more careful with those mitzvot that promise them wealth and the Sekula for good income. So the Gemara says, the answer for Rav Nachman is Tanayehi. It is a machloket Tanayim. You're right that Tosefta seems to support the view that you need all of these items to sanctify it. But there are Tanaim who disagree. Now the Gemara quotes from Megillah, the Tanya, Amar Rabbi Eliezer, Shematik Sheyu Boni Be'echal. I heard when they were building Eichal in time of Bayit Sheni, Asu Klaim, the Eichal. They put up curtains to represent the walls of what would have been the Eichal. Viklaim Lazarot. And they also put up Klaim around the Azara, meaning to demarcate where the Beit HaMikdash was. Ella, Shebe'echal Boni Be'bachutz. In Eichal, they placed the curtains on the inner edge of what would be the width of the wall, and they would build the wall from the outside. Ubazarot, in the Azara, was the opposite. The walls or the curtains would be towards the outer thickness of the wall, and Bonim Mibifim, and they would build the wall from the inside. This is easy to understand because it's about where the workers stand. When it comes to standing in the Azara, that's not a big deal to stand in the Azara. You have to be Tahor, but you don't have to be a Kohen, and not going in the area that is delineated as being off limits. So in that case, you put the Klaim in the outer perimeter of where the Mikdash was, and you build the wall inside of that perimeter. Then when it comes to the Eichal, when it comes to the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim, over there you have a problem both of Kedusha, as well as the impermissibility of entering into those areas. So there they put the curtain on the inner perimeter, and they built the wall on the outside. Amar Rabbi Yoshua, Shamati Shemakrivim Afal Pi Shein Bayit. I heard you can bring korbanot even though there's no Beit HaMikdash. Ochlim kodshei kodoshim, afal pi shein kohanim. And you can eat kodshei kodoshim, which have to be eaten inside of the perimeter of the azarot. You can eat those even though there are no curtains or there's no delineation. Kodshim kalim u'maiser sheni. Comes to kodshim kalim u'maiser sheni that need to be eaten inside of Yerushalayim. Afal pi shein choma, even though there's no wall to Yerushalayim. Mipnei, what's the reason for that? Kedusha rishona kitsha d'shaita. Because the original sanctification of Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael was permanent in nature. And that means that you don't need the physical walls or the physical barriers in order to have the sanctity be there. The sanctity comes from the fact that it was imbued with that sanctity originally and it never leaves. And so you can be makriv korbanot, you can do whatever you want, you can do all these mitzvot, even though there's no wall on Yerushalayim, there's no wall to the Beit HaMikdash. Or there's no perimeter that indicates where they end. Lav Michlau, from Rabbi Yeshua's statement that says the reasoning behind his position is that the original Kedusha was permanent, but doesn't that imply that Rabbi Lezer Savar lo kitshalatidavo? Rabbi Lezer believes that it wasn't Kadosh permanently. So now the Havamino of the Gemara is that the machlokini between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Lezer is whether the original sanctification or Kedusha was a permanent Kedusha. If you believe it's a permanent Kedusha, that's Rabbi Yeshua's position, then you don't need to do anything in order to restart the Avoda in the Mikdash. You simply put up a Mizbeach, you put the Korban on there, and the Kedusha that was imbued in that area is already there and sanctified it, and now you can do the Avoda without a re-sanctification or building. The other hand, Rabbi Eliezer believes that the original sanctification was null and void, and now you need to re-sanctify the area. How do you do that? How do you allow yourself to do Avoda in the Mikdash, or eat inside of Yerushalayim? You have to put up walls that indicate where those are, and then sanctify the area based on the perimeters that you're setting up. So in order to restart the Avoda, according to Rabbi Eliezer, you have to put up curtains, you have to give perimeters to those areas in order to re-sanctify it, and then utilize it until they built the walls. So the Klaim were a temporary measure that allowed them to bring the service back to the Mikdash, while they built the walls. But that's what allowed you to sanctify it. So here the Gemara says two things. Number one is the machloket there in the Mishnah is about whether the original sanctification was permanent or not. And the second that they're teaching you is that if the original sanctification is permanent, then you can bring back the avoda and the service without any building, without any delineation. Whereas if you believe that the original sanctification was null and void, to re-sanctify it, you'd have to put up walls, or to start the avoda again, you'd have to build, in a sense, the Mikdash. You can build a temporary structure that allows you to do it while you're building the permanent structure, but nevertheless, you need something there, and that's the necessity for the Klaim, according to Rabbi Eliezer. So now, that would explain Rabbi Nachman's position. He says, I'll subscribe to Rabbi Eliezer that the sanctification or the original sanctification was not permanent, and that's why you have to either put up Playim over here, or you'd have to re-sanctify it in the time of Bayit Sheni, whereas the author of the Tosefta holds like Rabbi Yeshua that the original Kedusha was permanent, and there was no ability to re-sanctify in the time of Bayit Sheni, because they were missing some of the protocol. So, Amar Le Ravina Le Rav Ashi, Mimai, how do you know that's what they're arguing about? Dilma, Dukuli Amma, Kedusha Rishona, Kitchel Shaita, Kitchel Tidabo. Maybe everybody believes that the original sanctification was permanent. Umar, Maidishmile Kamar. Umar, Maidishmile Kamar. And each one of them was telling over the Mesorah they had about what the practice was during the time of Bayit Sheni. According to that understanding that both of them agree the original sanctification was permanent, then why, according to Rabbi Eliezer, did you have to put up curtains in order to restart the Avodah in the time of Bayit Sheni? It wasn't a necessity. It wasn't a part of the protocol in order to allow you to do Avodah in the Mikdash. It was just simply tzniut. It was just appropriate to delineate the Mikdash and to make the area a more private area and not make it a big public spectacle when they were doing the Avodah. So in order to have some sort of sense of tzniut and structure, they put up the klayim, but it wasn't necessary for the sanctification. It was just exactly that. It was a temporary way to provide tzniut, and we know that that is something that becomes a central issue later on at the tail end of Bayit Sheni, with regards to the fact that Agrippus builds his palace next to the Beit HaMikdash and actually has it be higher than the walls of the Beit HaMikdash, and his dining room window overlooked the Beit HaMikdash where he was able to see the Avodah. And the Kohanim and the leadership at the time took tremendous offense to that, and they go to petition in Rome that he not be allowed to do this and that they stop him from doing this. And that leads to all sorts of issues and altercations and problems for the Kohen Gadol who goes to Rome in order to petition them. They are successful in the end in blocking his ability to do that because they put up a higher wall to block his view into the Beit HaMikdash. But from there you see that tension about the tzniut that was associated with the Avodah and the Mikdash. And that would explain why they would need Klayim, even though the sanctification was permanent and was not necessary to start the Avodah. We see that conceptually that there is this concept of tzniut. It's appropriate, even though it may not be necessary in order to restart the Avodah Mikdash. And that's why in Josephus he discusses this issue, again at the tail end of Bayit Sheni, about the king having a dining room window that overlooks the Avodah. Ela hani tenae. Rather, there is a machloket tanaim. It wasn't the one that we just brought, but it's another set of tanaim. Tanya, Amar Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi. Lama manu chachamim et elu? Why did the chachamim enumerate these cities? She'kesh'alu b'nei ha'gola, matzu elu v'kidshum. When the b'nei ha'gola returned to Eretz Yisrael, they found these cities, and they sanctified them. Aval rishonot batlu mishabat la'aretz. The original cities lost their sanctification after the land was conquered or with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the exile of the people from the land. Here it's telling you which cities in Eretz Yisrael have a status of Arei Choma, that they are considered to be walled cities, which has implications for a number of halachot, including the fact that Metzora has to be sent out of the city. He cannot be inside the walled city. Number two is that when you sell a house in that city, you have 1 year to redeem it. If you don't redeem it in that 1 year, it is now a permanent sale. And also, after the holiday of Purim came into existence, it also has impact in terms of whether you read the Megillah on the 14th or the 15th of Adar. So all of these have implications based on whether you're considered a walled city or not a walled city. So the way that Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi states it over here is that the walled cities were not determined by Yoshua ben Nun, but rather determined by the Gola that returns in the time of Bayit Sheni. Whatever cities they sanctified or they put up walls, those cities are considered to be walled cities. And that's the list that is found here. That list that we have of those walled cities is a list of the new cities that they put up and were Mikadesh. They sanctified them. Alma, Kasavar, Kedusha Rishona, Kitchel Shaita, Lo Kitchel Atidavo. Seems from that, Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi clearly believes that the original sanctification was not permanent. And that's why they had to re-sanctify them at the time of Bayit Sheni. Rashi makes a comment over here about Vikidshum that they sanctified them. He says, Lo perishli b'mamikudashim arei Eretz Yisrael. Says, I don't know how you sanctify cities in Eretz Yisrael. The Mishnah describes for us how you sanctify the Azarot, also how you sanctify Yerushalayim. But it doesn't tell you how do you sanctify, for instance, Har HaBayit. It doesn't tell you how you sanctify walled cities inside of Eretz Yisrael. Or even how you sanctify Eretz Yisrael as a whole. So Rashi over here says, Lo Yitparish, it's not explained. The Balei HaTosafot on the previous Amud in Divrei HaMatkil V'Yotzei actually over there asked the same question with regards to Har HaBayit and Arei Choma and walled cities. And he says there that Delo Efshar, V'yesh Lomar, Echa Delo Efshar, Lo Efshar. There's no way to bring a korban or take an item of Kedusha that is delineated by these items, then there's no way to do it. And the Kedusha comes simply from living and building them. Utility or utilizing them is what imbues them with that sanctity, and there is no formal process for sanctifying them. So Rashi and the Balei HaTosafot seem to be dealing with that same issue, which is, it speaks about sanctification over here, but how? Or in which method was that done? Rashi says he doesn't know, and Balei HaTosafot say, the left sharp, it's not possible to do it through korbanot, and so therefore sanctification must come through utility. So now the Gemara continues and says, very many. Is that really true? Is that Rabbi Shmuel Bar Rabbi Yossi's position? Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Rabbi Yossi, Michelu Bilvadayu? Were these the only cities that were considered to be kadosh or were considered to be walled cities? Halok Far Ne'amar. Doesn't it already say in Darim, Shishim Ir, Kol Chevel Argov, Mamlechet Ogba Bashan, Kol Eila Arim Bitzurot Choma Gevoha. So there you have a pasuk that tells you that in the area of Og Melech Bashan, which is basically the Golan, and those areas included 60 cities that were walled. So all of those should be cities that are deemed to be walled cities and have Kedusha. So why are you telling me that there's only these cities that are enumerated? What about all the other cities that are hinted to here in that pasuk? Elalama manu chachamim et elu. So then why did the chachamim specifically enumerate these cities as being cities that are a kadosh? Kishalu b'nei agola matzu elu v'kidushum. When the b'nei agola came back, they found these cities and they sanctified them. Mar says, Kichum? What do you mean, Kichum, they sanctified them? Hashta Amrina on the command, Lo Tzricha Dekdusha. You just were about to tell you in this position of Bishmo Rabbi Yossi that you don't need to sanctify them because the original Kedusha was permanent. So what does it mean, sanctify them? Ella Matsu Elu Umminaum. They found these cities and enumerated them. Below Elu Bilvad. But it's not the sole number of cities. That's not an exclusive list. Ella Kol Shetalebi Adcha Misoret Me'abutecha. Anything you have a Masorah about the fact that it was Mukevet Choma Mimot Yeshua Bin Nun, that had a wall in it from the time of Yeshua Bin Nun, Kol Mitzvot Elu Noheget Ba. All these mitzvot apply there, and again we enumerated before what mitzvot they include, which include the mitzvah of the Batei Rei Choma, the Shiluach Mitzoraim, as well as the fact that you're not allowed to change the open area around the city into fields. You have to leave a migrash around the city, and then beyond the migrash you have to leave a sadeh. All of these mitzvot apply to walled cities. But what you see from Yishmael and Rabbi Yossi is that the list that is brought in Arachin is not an exclusive list. It is simply a partial list of all the cities. So why did they enumerate? Those were the ones that they, when they came back, those are the cities that they knew for sure in the areas that they settled in that they knew were from Yeshua Bin Nun's time. But there might be other ones. If you have a Masorah that this city had a wall from the time of Yeshua Bin Nun, then that would be the case that it would have that Kedusha. Because the Kedusha Rishona was permanent. And so therefore it's determined by the walled cities from the time of Yeshua Bin Nun. And if they were sanctified, they remained sanctified forever. Gemara says, Kasha the Rabbi Shmuel ber Rabbi Yossi, other Rabbi Shmuel ber Rabbi Yossi. You have a stira in Rabbi Shmuel ber Rabbi Yossi. The first braita that we brought says that Rabbi Shmuel ber Rabbi Yossi's position is that the original Kedusha is not permanent. And that's why they had to re-sanctify them at the time of the Bnei Gola coming back. And that's what that list is doing. It's telling you which cities are Batei Rechoma that were re-sanctified. On the other hand, the second Braita that we brought into Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi indicates that the first Kedusha was permanent. And that's why these cities, as well as many other cities that you have a Masorah about that had walls from time Yeshua Bin Nun, all of them would be Kadosh. So Ibai Deima Trei Tanei Alibet Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi. One way to explain it is it's two Tanaim who thought that that was the position of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Rabbi Yossi. They're arguing about what that position of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Rabbi Yossi was. Ibaidema Chanaminai Rabbi Elazar Bar Rabbi Yossi. That one of them is not Rabbi Shmuel Bar Rabbi Yossi, but rather Rabbi Elazar Bar Rabbi Yossi Amra. And then there wouldn't be a stira. Tanya, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yossi Omer, and here we have support for the fact that Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yossi's position is that the original Kedusha, Kedusha Rishona, was permanent. Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, Asher lo choma, that it has no wall to it. The word is written in the Torah, Lamed Aleph. Asher lo choma, that doesn't have a wall. The Kree, the reading of the Pasuk is, Asher lo choma, Lamed Vav, which means that it does have a wall. This is describing the requirements of Batei Arei Choma. It says about a city, Asher Lo Choma, that has a wall to it. But why is the Ktiv Lamed Aleph and the Kri Lamed Vav? Avo Bishin Lo Akshav Vayelo Kodem. That's because the Asher Lo Choma means, even if it doesn't have a wall now, Asher Lo Choma, but it did have a wall in the past, then it is Kadosh, Bik Dushat Arei Choma, and that is because of this Kri and Ktiv. So the way they read the Pasuk is, Asher lo choma, this is a city that has no wall today, but Asher lo choma, but it did have a wall in the past, that is an arei choma, that is considered to be a walled city, and it has all the requirements of a walled city. But you see from there that Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi believes that the Kedusha Rishona was what sanctified these cities, and therefore he could be that author of the position that we brought in the second brayta, that Kedusha Rishona was permanent. Now, I always say over the board, when we read this, drasha and the psukim, which is, asher lo choma, asher lo choma, it does or doesn't have a wall. And the nice way to explain it is, asher lo choma, a city that has a wall around it, lamed vav, lo choma, lamed aleph choma, that's not a real wall. Asher lo choma, a city that does not have a wall around it, lamed aleph, then lo choma, the wall around the city is lamed vav, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So in a city that has a wall around it, they might think they're protected, but it's not a real wall, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the wall that protects the city, not the physical wall. And the other way around, a city that doesn't have a wall, you might think they don't have protection. Lo Choma, God is their Choma, is their wall, and He's the one that provides them the protection. So it's an important Musar Haskel that we should take to heart, the idea that physical walls and military might are not the only things that make a difference. You have to do your ishtadlut, but in the end, it's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we have to believe and know that it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu that runs things, and He's the real wall, and He's the real defender of Klal Yisrael. Now, over here, the Gemara ends with this idea that there's a machloket about Kedusha Rishona and Kedusha Shnia, and it seems to be from the Gemara that they conflate the issues. Over here, in the second machloket that we brought, machloket was not about Yerushalayim, or the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash, the bread that we brought from Megillah, that clearly was the machloket. Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua, when we suggested it was a machloket, we're arguing about the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim. And then we tried to parlay that into a machloket Tanaim. The Gemara then said, no, everybody agrees that Kedusha Rishona was permanent. So we brought another machloket Tanaim to prove that there is such a machloket Tanaim. But this machloket Tanaim spoke about Kedushat HaAretz, speaking about the cities, the walled cities in Eretz Yisrael. And the Gemara says, well, that machloket is applicable to our machloket over here, which conflates the issue of Kedushat HaAretz and Kedushat HaMikdash. Many Rishonim, we discussed this when we had this in the Gemara in Makot, and the Tosafot over here hits to it a little bit. The Rishonim believe that the two are independent. Just because you believe Kedushat HaAretz is permanent doesn't mean that you believe Kedushat HaMikdash is permanent, and vice versa. If you think that Kedushat HaMikdash is permanent, doesn't mean that you believe Kedushat HaAretz is permanent. They are independent. Their Kedushat derives from a different source or for a different reason, and therefore they could be independent. One of them could be permanently Kadosh, and one of them could be Kadosh only temporarily, and it doesn't matter in which direction. You could have reasons to believe that the Aretz is more Kadosh and more permanently Kadosh than the Mikdash, and vice versa. You can believe that the Mikdash Yerushalayim is permanently Kadosh, and the Aretz is not permanently Kadosh, which is the view of the Rambam. The Rambam has an unusual view about this, where he seems to indicate that the Kedusha Rishona was permanent with regards to Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash, because of the Hashrat HaShchinah, which imbued it with Kedusha and is permanent, versus the Kedusha Daritz, which was Batel when they were thrown out of the land. But then the Rambam seems to have a cryptic statement where he says that the Kedusha of Ezra, when they were Mekadesh Daritz, is a permanent Kedusha. And that's what we spoke about in Masechet Makot, with regards to how to reconcile that Rambam and Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik in Al HaTshuva, the explanation that he tries to give for this seemingly difficult Rambam. The Baal Tosafot in Zvachim and other places bring the fact that you could separate between the two and they go in both directions. Both in the direction that the Aretz is Kadosh and the Mikdash is not, or the Mikdash is Kadosh and the Aretz is not, brings both views there, as well as the view that they're connected, and that both of them are Kadosh either permanently, or both of them are not Kadosh permanently. But it's clear here from this Gemara that the Gemara is connecting the two, even though we find otherwise in other places in Shas. The other thing the Baal Tosafot do over here, and it's a new view that we haven't discussed before, is that they think there's possibly a third level of Kedusha that differentiates itself. So far we've spoken about Kedushat Aretz. Kedushat Aretz is impact in terms of Shvi'it, Trumot, Masrot, any mitzvot of Tluyot Baretz. Kedushat HaMikdash has to do with the sanctity of the Mikdash. It has ramifications in terms of bringing Korbanot. Bizman HaZeh, even though there's no Beit HaMikdash, has ramifications in terms of your ability to ascend Har HaBayit, or whether it's off limits or not. So that is affected by Kedushat HaMikdash. So those are the two that we've spoken about until now. Tosafot here introduces a third area of Kedusha, which is what he calls Kedushat Mechitza. It's a Kedusha that is determined by a perimeter or a wall around it. He says that maybe what the Gemara is suggesting over here is that Kedushat Mechitza is permanent or not permanent. The Machloket over here is about Kedushat Mechitza. And then he could then continue to say that Kedushat Mikdash and Aretz are separate. But over here, the reason the Gemara brings this about the Arei Chuma and then implies that that would affect the Kedusha of Yerushalayim is because what is the Kedusha of Arei Chuma? Walled cities, the Kedusha is that the perimeter of the wall determines what's in the city and what's out of the city, what the rules are here and what the rules are about the city as a whole. So too, the Kedusha of Yerushalayim in terms of being a walled area and the Kedusha of the Mikdash in terms of being a delineated area, that's also Kedusha Mechitza. It's a limit to the areas of Kedusha. And so what the Baal Tosafot suggests over here is that you could believe that Kedusha Aretz is Batel. Kedusha of the Aretz is no longer extant. Yet you believe that Batei Chuma are Kadosh permanently because they are Kedusha Mechitza. And that would have ramifications on Yerushalayim. That Yerushalayim is Kadosh because it's Kedusha Mechitza. And so in that way, you could actually then, again, break down what you believe. You could say, Kedushat Aretz is not permanent. Kedushat Yerushalayim is determined by Kedushat Mechitza, which is what we just discussed here. And Batei Arei Chuma would have the same din as Yerushalayim and the Mikdash. And that's how you could then explain this Gemara as not conflating the issues of Aretz and Mikdash, but simply saying there's another category of Kedusha, which is called Kedushat Mechitza, and that is what's being discussed over here. I just want to note, even though, again, we spoke about this much more extensively in Makot, that over here there is a Beit HaBechira, a Meiri, which is an important Meiri because he brings the position of the other Rishonim, where he says, Shita zu shekatavna l'chalek ben shara et Yisrael Yerushalayim, that Shita, the divide between Eretz and Yerushalayim, u'mikdash kachu dat gudulei ha-mechabrim. That's the view of the great writers. It's obviously a veiled reference to the Rambam, as well as other Rishonim, Shkatvu, Tein, Beperush. They wrote that explicitly. V'chol shata motze v'tamud, sheredacha misham shkudusha rishona lo kitshala atid. Anytime you find where it says that the kudusha rishona was not permanent, atam mefarsha v'shar Eretz Yisrael. You interpret that to be with regards to the land, or the rest of Eretz Yisrael. V'chol shiredacha misham shkitshala atid. And if you find a Gemara that seems to lean in favor of saying that the kudusha is permanent, Mamidab Yerushalayim B'Mikdash. You say that's referring to Mikdash and Yerushalayim. And that's the Meiri he brings from the other Rishonim. But then he brings, G'dolei Mefarshim Katvu B'Hagotehem. G'dolei Mefarshim write in their notes. Their notes are the comments or the glosses of the Ravid on the Rambam. The Ravid on the Rambam says he made it all up. Where did he ever find such a thing that there is this type of difference? And the Ravid clearly states that the Kedushat HaAretz was not permanent, as well as Kedushat Yerushalayim was not permanent. And he says, G'dolei Mefarshim Katvu B'Hagotehem Sh'af Kedusha Shniya Lo Ne'amra L'Shar Eretz Yisrael. Even in the Kedusha Shniya, it was not permanent. Meaning the Ravid believes, even though they re-sanctified it in the time of Bayit Sheni, that was not permanent. About Yerushalayim Mikdash, Yudei Ezra Shatidim L'Ishtanot Ulit Kadesh B'Kavod Olami. And Ezra knew that there would be a permanent Kedusha that would be imbued in Yerushalayim in the time of Bayit Shlishi. And therefore, he did not sanctify it at that time in a permanent sanctification. And the ramifications of that are, if you walk on Har HaBayit, There's no chiyuv karet. So here the Meiri brings the sheet of the Raivad that the Kedusha of Yerushalayim is not permanent and the Kedusha of the Haaretz is not permanent. The Raivad there is explicit that Yerushalayim's Kedusha is not permanent, and he says there's no chiyuv karet. You can go up into Har HaBayit and it's not a sur because there is no Kedusha there. In terms of Kedusha of the Haaretz, he brings, it seems, he implies that there is no permanent Kedusha, but he does say a feel of the Rabbi Yossi who believes that Kedushat Rishonah is permanent, that might only be with regards to Eretz Yisrael and not the Mikdash. So he does bring an opinion that Kedushat Eretz is permanent, but nevertheless, it seems he leans heavily in favor of saying it is not permanent, and that's why today, when we rely on some of the kulot we have is that the Raivan clearly believes that whatever we do with regards to Trumot and Masrot are not the Oraita, because he believes there is no permanent Kedushat Eretz. For others who believe there is permanent Kedushat Eretz, you have to deal with what our practice is as to whether we think it's Deoraita or Derabanan. And again, even the Rambam, who thinks that the Kedusha Shniya was permanent with regards to the Aretz, he still believes that many of those mitzvot are not Deoraita because they have other requirements, including Rov Am Yisrael would be in Eretz Yisrael, which is not the case, and that's why they are Derabanan. But then the Meiri says something striking. He says, V'minaka Pashut says, the practice today, the simple practice is the Kaneshem, is to go up to Har HaBayit. The Fi Masha Shamanu, based on what I hear, people go to Har HaBayit all the time. Also from that it would imply that you can't eat Maisu Sheni where there are no walls. Based on what we said in other places, that you need the wall in terms of the Mechitza to make it into a delineated place where you can eat the Maisu Sheni, as well as where it makes it that you can no longer redeem the Maisu Sheni. So here the Meiri adds on top of what the Raivad says, that there is no permanent Kedushat Yerushalayim, so there's no Chiyuv Karet. Over here, the Meiri adds that the common practice he hears is that people ascended Har HaBayit all the time. And so this is one of the sources that's brought for those that ascend Har HaBayit today, even though they're careful for the Shito that do believe that there is a Kedushat Yerushalayim. Nevertheless, from the Raivad and the Meiri, it would be carte blanche. You could enter that area even without being Torah, and you could enter any area on Har HaBayit. So nevertheless, we're choshesh for the other Shito, but that is a strong support for those that want to ascend Har HaBayit, that both the Raivad and the Meiri suggest that it's not a sur, and that it was the practice at the time that people ascended to Har HaBayit. Again, there are other Shitot and other reasons to be much more careful or not so brash about going up to Har HaBayit. At least here you see the shita of the Meiri because it's brought here in the Gemara in Shavuot, so I wanted to make sure to share it with you. So now the Gemara continues. Nitma ba'azara ne'oma mimenu tuma. The case in our Mishnah where he became tamei in the azara, and then he forgot the fact that he was tamei. So he's internal already when he becomes tamei. Rashi says, and we saw this before, I noted this by the Mishnah, Rashi believes that when it comes to being tamei inside the Mikdash, you're only in violation of an aseh. If you don't exit, you're not in violation of the lo taseh. As Rashi says, that the lo taseh only seems to indicate that you may not enter the area of bitumah. But if you're already in the area, then that lo taseh does not apply to you. The Balei HaTosfot over here disagree with Rashi and say that that is not the case at all, and that even when you're internally, there is an isur lav. But then you have to explain the Gemara's question here, which is tumah ba'azara minalan. How do we know that you're chayav for tumah ba'azara? For Rashi, it makes sense. Rashi thinks there's no lav here. So the question of the Gemara is, how do you know you get malkot? How do you know you have to bring a korban or levi or raid for these situations if the lav does not apply to you? Only the assay applies to you. That's the question according to Rashi. According to the Balei Tosafot, where the lav does apply to you, then what's the nature of the Gemara's question? So it either could be that the Gemara is asking about korban or levi or raid. Yes, you have a lav. So yes, there is a lota assay involved, so you'll get malkot. With regards to being the korban or levi arayt, where do you have evidence of the fact that there's a chiyuv korban when you're internal? That's one way. Or the other way for even the Balei Tosafot is that it is a question even about malkot. And what the Tosafot is suggesting is the Gemara here is looking for the onesh, the punishment, but the azhara, the lav that tells you that that is the punishment, is the lav that we saw before in Parshat Naso that says you're not allowed to enter the areas that are restricted bitumah, v'lo yitamu et machanehem, that you may not defile the machaneh by entering. So that's the machloket here. Rashi thinks that there is no lav at all, and that's what the Gemara is searching for. Tosafot thinks there is a lav, but the Gemara is either searching for How do you know you're chayav a korban? Or is searching for the fact that once we know the onesh and that korban, that the azhara came from the love of lotamu mamachanehem. So Gemara says, Amar Belazar, ketuv echad omer et mishkan Hashem timei. Ketuv echad omer ki et mikdash Hashem timei. Parshat Chukat, with regards to tumata meit, over there it says, if you do not purify yourself and you enter into the mikdash, you are a chayav karet, because et mishkan Hashem timei, you defiled the mishkan. The other pasuk says et mikdash Hashem timei, which is a change in language. One time it says mishkan, one time it says mikdash. So now, im eino inyan letumah shebachutz, neino inyan letumah shebifnim. Since the pasuk is extraneous, and we don't need it for the tumah bachutz, because we already have a lav for that, then the extra pasuk is going to come to teach you that there is a lav, or a restriction, or a violation, if you become tamei inside and do not exit in the most expeditious way. Where it says, v'krai me'atrei, are the psukim really extraneous over here? Ha mitzvah tzriche, we need it for this limud. Tanya, blazo merim nemar mishkan lamener mikdash, ner mikdash lamener mishkan. Why does the Torah call it a mishkan and a mishkadash? Why does it either say mikdash or mishkan? Why does it give you both? Ilu nemar mishkan, because it had only written mishkan. Below nemar mikdash, and had not written the word mikdash, hayiti omer, I would have concluded al mishkan yei chayav. For the mishkan, you are chayav for entering bitumah. Sharei Meshuach b'shem ha-mishcha. The sanctity of the Mishkan was imbued by Moshe Rabbeinu when he anointed it with the Shem ha-mishcha. Al Mikdash lo yechayav, but the Mikdash, that's not how they sanctified it. They didn't use the Shem ha-mishcha, rather either through utility or through the protocol that was mentioned in our Mishnah. That's how they sanctified it. So therefore, it doesn't have as high a level of Kedusha. And for that reason, you would believe that you don't have a Chiyub Karet if you entered into the Mikdash bitumah. If it only had Mikdash, not Mishkan, I would say the reason you're Chayav Karet for entering the Mikdash B'tumah is, HaMikdash Yei Chayav Sharei Kedushata O Kedushat Olam. We'll read it like Rashi now, which is that the Kedusha of the Bayit is permanent. And since it's permanent, that's why you're Chayav if you enter B'tumah. V'al Mishkan Lo Yei Chayav. But then for the Mishkan, which is a temporary Kedusha, there you would not be Chayav for entering B'tumah. And Rashi explains over here, that, what does Kedushat Olam mean, or what's the ramifications of that? Not only what we discussed before, which is ascending Har HaBayit, but also the fact that you can't bring Bamot after Yerushalayim is sanctified. Once Yerushalayim is sanctified, that's the end of the era of Bamot, and the only place you can bring Korbanot from there to forward is in Yerushalayim, in the Makom HaMikdash. Bali HaTosafot disagree with Rashi over here, and say when it says Kedushat Olam, it doesn't mean a permanent Kedusha. He says if that's the case, then we'd have an answer to many of our questions. Depending on who the author of this bright is, we have the author of the bright is Rabbi Elazar. There was an alternate Girsah that Tosafot notes might have been Rabbi Eliezer. But in either case, you would now know what their opinion is. Rabbi Elazar or Rabbi Eliezer, their opinion must be that the original Kedusha is permanent. Otherwise, why would you say Kedusha Olam? So Tosafot says that can't be the explanation over here because the Gemara should have brought this bright as a source for concluding what their opinion is in other places in Shas. The answer would be, they believe Kedusha Rishona is permanent because of the fact that Yerushalayim is considered to be a Kedushat Olam. So the Bali Tosafot disagree and bring two other possibilities. Either one is, Vayesh Tefaresh Kedushat Olam She'erichu B'Kedusha Yoter. It says Kedusha Olam doesn't mean permanent Kedusha, but rather means a longer Kedusha. The Mikdash stood for a longer time than the Mishkan, and so therefore its Kedusha is considered to be different or a higher level Kedusha. You could argue that the Mikdash is a structure, a permanent structure, versus the Mishkan, which is a temporary or traveling structure. But either one of those would indicate that there's a higher level of Kedusha to the Mikdash. Even Rishonim, who don't like Rashi's explanation, are not so fond of this explanation of the Bali Tosafot, because it doesn't seem to be any real reason that just because it stood longer, that it should be considered Le'olam versus the Mishkan. And it might even be questionable as to whether the Mikdash did stand for longer than the Mishkan. Inami, Tosafot gives another answer. The reason is because once Yerushalayim was chosen as the Makom HaKadosh, there's no other place to sanctify. Even if you're going to come back and re-sanctify a location for the Mikdash, it's going to be in Yerushalayim. So both in the Mishkan, which is a traveling Mishkan, and once it's destroyed, if you rebuilt the Mishkan, you can build it anywhere, and you can put the structure up anywhere. With regards to the Mikdash, that's not true. Once Yerushalayim was chosen, it remains the chosen city, even if it loses its Kedusha, Nevertheless, it is the chosen city. If you want to re-sanctify, you're going to re-sanctify in that same location. So that's what Tosafa means, that it's Kushat Olam. Yerushalayim is now the permanently chosen city, as opposed to the Mishkan, which is always a temporary structure, and even if you were to replace it, you could move it from Shiloh to another location. V'kach ne'emar Mishkan, v'kach ne'emar Mikdash. That's why you have two psukim, one to tell you Mishkan, one to tell you Mikdash, and tell you your chayav for entering Betumah into both of these areas. Even though each one has a reason for you to believe that it's more chamor, so we bring both of them to teach you that both of them are a violation of entering into a sanctified place, Betumah. But if that's the case, we need both psukim. We assume that Mishkan Hashem, Mikdash Hashem, one of them was extraneous. And that's how we learned about being inside and being tamei and being chayav. Mar says, you need those. Mishkan and Mikdash will tell you that both of those structures are a violation of its sanctity when you go in there, Betumah, your chayav karet. Tosafot in Yoma, which is cross-referenced here in the Tosafot O-E-D-B-E-D, which is the Gemara and Mem Dalet Amud Aleph, notes that there is also another nafkamina here between whether it was Nitkadesh, B'Shem, and Mishkar or not, which is that there was inherent Kedushah to the Mishkan. That means even after the Mishkan went out of service, or something in the Mishkan was no longer necessary, it still was imbued with Kedushah and has to go into Genizah. As opposed to the Beit HaMikdash, which was not Nitkadesh, B'Shem, and Mishkar, then only when it is in service of the Mikdash, it's in the Binyan HaMikdash, it's that Kedushah. Once it's removed from the Beit HaMikdash, it no longer has Kedushah, because it wasn't imbued with inherent Kedushah, it only has Kedushah because it's part of the structure of the Beit HaMikdash. Therefore, the Krashim, the boards of the Mishkan, had permanent Kedushah, so even after the Mishkan's out of service, those boards have Kedushah, and they were put into Genizah. As opposed to the stones of the Beit HaMikdash, or the structure of the Beit HaMikdash, that only have Kedushah when they're a part of the Binyan. But if something breaks or they take them out, those stones no longer have any inherent Kedushah to them. Now the Gemara says, Rabbi Elazar Ocha Kagashile. This is what was bothering Rabbi Elazar. This is the limud that comes from Mishkan and Mikdash, whether it's a Rabbi Elazar or a Rabbi Elazar. Michtei, Mishkan ikre Mikdash, or Mikdash ikre Mishkan. The terms are actually used interchangeably in the Torah. Nichta bo idi v'idi Mikdash, or idi v'idi Mishkan. So if that's the case, that Mikdash and Mishkan are interchangeable, then you can read it in the Psukim, either both of them Mishkan, or both of them Mikdash, and you would have learned the same thing, which is you have two Psukim telling us the same thing. You don't need one of them because it's a duplication. That would teach you that it's referring to the Mikdash or it's referring to the Mishkan. And in either way, you'd get both structures incorporated in this mitzvah. Mishkan or Mikdash lamali. So then why does the Torah change the way it's written? Shmamina tarte. From there you conclude two different issues, which is both the fact that Mishkan and Mikdash are restricted from being entered Bitumah. And number two is that you also know that not only is there a restriction Bachutz, if you're Tamei Bachutz to enter, but even if you became Tamei Bifnim and you didn't exit, then you're in violation of a lav, you would get Malkot for it. You would also, if you did a Bishogeg, you would have to bring a Korban Ulevi Yoreid, and that would then mean that there's both a violation of a lav and an assay when you are inside the Mikdash Bitumah. So Mara says, now let's just go back and check the facts over here. Bishlam Mikdash Ikre Mishkan, we find that the Mikdash is called a Mishkan Dichtiv. Natati Mishkani Bitochechem. Because it says, I will place my Mishkan, my dwelling, my presence amongst you. That is found in the Tochecha in Sefer Vayikra and Pashat Vechukotai. And Rashi over here says that that means that anywhere where Hashem puts his presence, that's called a Mishkan. So that's whether it's in the Mishkan itself, or whether it's in the Mikdash. Anything where Hashem dwells or places his Shekhinah amongst you, that's called a Mishkan. You can see here, Masora Shas notes that in Irvin, Perish Rashi, Bofen Achera, Yoter Mibuar. Rashi explains it a little differently, and over there he says that the Mishkan was already built. So that Pasuk in Vayikra cannot be referencing to the Mishkan, which is already there, but it's a time that in the future when Hashem brings his presence amongst you, and that must be a reference to the Mikdash. So from that you see that the Mikdash is called a Mishkan, and that's what Rashi says in Erevin. Ela Mishkan Nikre Mikdash Minolan. Where do you find that the Mishkan is called a Mikdash? Ilein Rimichti V'nasu Akehatim Noseha Mikdash. That the Katim, well, then traveled, where they were the ones carrying the Mikdash. And obviously the Katim don't carry the Mikdash, they carry the Mishkan. So you would say there that the two are synonymous from that. How about Aron Ktiv? That is not speaking about the Mishkan as a whole, rather speaking about the charge
of the Bnei Kehat. The Bnei Kehat were in charge of all the kelim that were kadosh, like the Aron and the Mizbeach and the Shulchan and the Menorah. They were in charge of transporting them. So when it says over there, the Katim Nosei HaMikdash, doesn't mean the Mikdash in the sense of a structure, means Mikdash in the sense of Mikudash, items that are sanctified. So they're charged with carrying the sanctified items, and that's what it says here, HaUvaron K'tiv. It's not speaking about the Mishkan as a whole, it's speaking about the Kleya Mishkan, which Bnei Kehat were responsible for. Ela Mi'ocha, it comes here from Parshat Truma, which is Vasuli Mikdash, Vishakanti Mitocham. You will make for me a Mikdash, and I will dwell amongst you. Uchtev. And it says afterwards, Kol Asher Ani Mareh Otcha Et Tavnit HaMishkan. Clearly, the Psukim subsequent to that are speaking about the building of the Mishkan. And so that reference of Mikdash is clearly to the Mishkan, and that's how we see the Mishkan is also called a Mikdash. The Bali Tosafot over here deal with what is a very difficult issue, which is if you go through Shas, you'll find that in some places the Gemara demands two different psukim to teach you whether Mishkan and Mikdash, or it's applicable both to the Mishkan and the Mikdash. In other places it says Mishkan and Mikdash are interchangeable. It says, which is it? What is the conclusion of the Gemara? Do you need a limud or do you not need a limud for Mishkan and Mikdash? It says it's very confusing based on the sugyot come up in Shas. So he brings two answers to this. One is answer he brings from the Rabbeinu Chaim HaKohen. Chaim Echalek. He differentiated between Davar She'enu Taluoi B'Kdushat Makom. Anything that has nothing to do with the Kdusha or the sanctity of the location. There you only need one pasuk for both Mishkan and Mikdash because they're interchangeable. Anything that has to do with the sanctity of the location. Lo Gamri Mehadodi. They're not learned from each other. The reason we gave up above by Rabbi Lazar, which is their reasons to believe that the Mikdash is more chamor, and the reasons to believe that Mishkan is more chamor. So what the Rabbeinu Chaim suggests over here is that the difference between the Gemaras that require two psukim, one for the Mikdash, one for the Mishkan, is they're dealing with Kushat Hamakom, the sanctity of the location. And that sanctity has to be clearly defined for the Mishkan and the Mikdash. Now then, when you're talking about sanctity in general, or something to do with the protocol in these areas, that you can use one pasuk to teach you about Mishkan and Mikdash, but it's not focused on Kedushat HaMakom, which is the differentiating factor that we noted in the Gemara between these two items. That's the way the Rabbeinu Chaim explains it. The Tosafot raises other issues with that explanation. And then you have another explanation he brings from Rabbeinu Shlomo Midar V'yayish, he says that you can learn one from the other. The conclusion of the Gemara here, and this is what Rabbi Elazar says, is that Mishkan and Mikdash are interchangeable, and you can learn one from the other. And this is the explanation here. Im ne'amar Mikdash, lama ne'amar Mishkan. Klomar. Came the answer to Mikdav Tarvayu, Mishum Tumash Bifnim, Kedama Rabbi Elazar, Amai Shanikra, Bidibure. Rabbeinu Shlomo says that Enochanami, that Rabbi Elazar believes that Mikdash and Mishkan are interchangeable all over Shas, and you only need one Rimud in order to teach you both of them. And the nature of the question over here is not why you need Mishkan and Mikdash, but the reason that you need two of them is to teach you the din of Bifnim, which is to teach you not only Bachot, but also Bifnim. So you need the two of them to do that. But then his question is, once you're doing that already, why say Mikdash and Mishkan? Mishkan and Mikdash, say Mishkan, Mishkan, or Mikdash, Mikdash. And that would have sufficed. And that's the nature of his question. So the answer to that question is, had you written Mikdash twice, I would have thought that meant to exclude the Mishkan. Or if you wrote Mishkan twice, I would have thought that came to exclude the Mikdash. So therefore, it switched between them, Mikdash and Mishkan, to tell you don't read too much into Mikdash or Mishkan. They're not exclusive in any way. But it also teaches you the din of not only Bechutz, but also Bifnim, Tuma has ramifications. And then Tosafot has questions on that Shita. And again, each Shita has a little hole in it, but Tosafot is trying to reconcile in Shas what that means in terms of the fact that Mishkan and Mikdash are interchangeable, yet in many places we find the Gemara asking for a source for the Mishkan and a source for the Mikdash. Right, our Mishnah says that a person who bows down, or he tarries the amount of time to bow down, that person is chayav for becoming tamei internally and not exiting in an expeditious manner. Amarava lo shanu elashish tachaveh klape pnim. That's only true if he bows down facing Marav, the western side of the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Aval yishtachaveh klape chutz, Shaha in lo shaha lo. If he bows down facing the eastern side or the exit, then he's only chayav if he tarries. He's not chayav if he doesn't tarry. The way that Rashi explains it is that when you bow down facing the marav, the west, or towards the Kodesh HaKodeshim, that is ishtachavah. And therefore you're in violation of tarrying because you bow down. Bowing down is not allowed when you're tamei, and that's the violation. On the way out, if you bow facing the doorway or the exit, then you're not bowing. It's not classified as bowing down because you only bow towards Hashem. You don't bow with your back towards Hashem. So that's not considered to be bowing. So the only thing you're going to be chayav for up there is that you took too long to leave the Mikdash. So it's not about whether you bowed or didn't bow. It's a question of did you tarry the amount of time to bow. Now you're going to say, well, isn't that obvious? If he bowed down on the way out, then he clearly waited the amount of time to bow down. The answer to that is no. There is a standard amount of time, which we're going to see in a second here in the Gemara, as to how long it takes to bow down. If you did a very quick bowing, then maybe you would be there less than the time of Kedei Hishtakava. So there is an objective amount of time for Hishtakava. You could do it slower than that or faster than that. So that means if you did it faster than that on your way out, you would not be chayav for the bowing. The only way you can be chayav is because you tarried, but you did it in less time than the tarrying delay is required, and then you would not be chayav. So that's one way that Rava's statement is brought here, is qualifying the Mishnah, the ratio of the Mishnah, that says that there are two different ways to be chayav. Iga d'matne la seifa. Some say it on the latter part. So that was on the ishtachava part, on the bowing part. It's only if you bow facing inward that that's the case. When you bow outwards, that's not the case. The other way to read it is on the seifa, which is the oshishak de ishtachava, that he tarried the amount of time it takes to bow. Miklal, the ishtachava gufa b'yishia. That implies that bowing itself requires a delay or a tearing. Amarava lo shnona sheishtachavek lape chutz. That's only when you're bowing to the outside. When you bow to the outside, it's not enough that you bow down. You also need the tearing. Aval klape pneim abagad lo shah. You bow facing inward towards the mikdash, then the bowing itself is problematic. So the truth is, it doesn't matter whether Rava's modifying the first line of the Mishnah of hishtachava, or he's modifying the second line of the Mishnah, which is Shihiya, Kedei Hishtachava. In either case, he comes to the same conclusion, which is that Hishtachava Klape Pnim is an automatic violation. Hishtachava Klape Chutz is a violation if it took you the amount of time that is standard for Hishtachava. V'achi kama Hishtachava Klape Pnim, or if he bowed down facing towards the Mikdash, O Shisha Kedei Hishtachava Bahach, Hishtachava Klape Chutz, or he tarried the amount of time it takes to bow, bowing when he's going out, chayav. In all those cases, he is chayav. Hechidami ishtachava d'ipashia. Hechidami ishtachava d'leipashia. So the question that we posed before, which is, if you're bowing down, isn't that by definition kedei ishtachava? So that's what the Gemara wants to understand here. What's a bowing with a delay? And what's a bowing without a delay? Why is there any difference between them? So d'leipashia, zo kriya balmi. A bowing that has no shia or tarrying is a case where you just bow down and you got up and you left. Deepa shia, pishit yadayim raglayim. A ishtachava that involves tarrying is when you bow down by prostrating yourself on the ground completely. Flat out on the ground with your hands and legs stretched out. So there you have ishtachava, which is just kriya ba'alma, bowing down alone. And the other one is you're prostrating before a kodesh baruch hu. So that's a ishtachava that involves a delay. Pekama shi'ur shi'ya. So then what's the way to demarcate that difference in time? Gemara is saying now that there's a difference between just bowing, which is bowing down on your knees, versus bowing down with a delay. Bowing down with a delay is when you prostrate yourself before a Kodesh Baruch Hu, when you do pishut yadayim reglayim, that is considered to be bowing with a delay in it. But how long is that time? What's the measure of that time? Ligi bar Rav Yitzchak bar Nachmani v'chadimei. There's a machlok between Rabbi Yisrael ben Nachmani and someone who was with him, Umanu, who's that other Amora, Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi. Ramila Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi, some say it was Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi, Bechad Yimei, and someone with him was his Bar Plukta, Umanu Rabbi Yisrael ben Nachmani. It was Rabbi Yisrael ben Nachmani who argued on him. Ramila Rabbi Shimon ben Nachmani. And some say, no, it wasn't Rabbi Yisrael ben Nachmani, but rather Rabbi Shimon ben Nachmani. Chadamar ki memrei dahai psuka. One of them says, like the amount of time it takes you in an average way to read this pasuk. From the middle of the pasuk till the end, and here's the pasuk. All Bnei Yisrael were witnessing when the great fire came down, Uchvod Hashem al Habayit, and then the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the glory of God, filled the Beit HaMikdash. Vayichre'u apayim arza al haritzpah. They fell on their faces on the ground. Vayishtachavu, and they bowed v'hodot Hashem. And they gave praise and thanks to Hashem. Ki tov k'dolam chasto. That they said that God is great and it does good. And His chesed is forever. His kindness is forever. This is again with the consecration, the inauguration of the Bayit Rishon by Shlomo HaMelech, which is being described in Divrei Yamim Bet. This is what the people's reaction was to the presence of the Shekhinah. And obviously, the Pasuk is not just chosen randomly, but the Pasuk has relevance thematically to what we're discussing over here, which means bowing down, and what it takes, or what's the amount of time it takes to bow down in the Mikdash when you have the presence of the Shekhinah. So the first Deyah believes that the reading of the entire Pasuk is the amount of time it takes to do Pishut Yadayim V'Raglayim. And the second opinion says only from the word Vayichre'u Apayim Arza. From that word to the end of the Pasuk, basically half the Pasuk is the amount of time. Reading it in a normal paced manner, that's the amount of time of Ishtachavaya with Shi'iyah. That's not simply bowing, that's bowing with a delay. The bowing with a delay is caused because you're not just bowing on your knees, you're bowing by prostrating yourself out. And that time that elapses is either the reading of the entire Pasuk or the reading from Vayichre'u until the end of the Pasuk. So the Tanur Rabbanan, now the Gemara is going to explain to us different forms of bowing. Kida alapayim. Kida is when one falls on their face. V'cheinu omer. V'tikot batsheva apayim aretz. That batsheva fell down on her face on the ground. So you see that kida is associated with your face touching the ground. Kriya albikayim. Koreya is when you fall on your knees. Koreim is from the word kara, which is to bow or to bend. And that has to do with your knees. When a person falls on their knees, that's called kriya. V'cheinu omer michro al birkav. Says there by Shlomo HaMelech in Malachim Aleph, after he davens and beseeches Hashem, he gets up from being on his knees in front of Hashem. Yishtachava zo pishut yadayim v'raglayim. And when you say yishtachava, that is prostrating oneself. That is the spreading out of one's hands and legs. V'cheinu omer, it says, havo navo ani v'imcha v'achecha yishtachava d'charetza. The dreams of Yosef, Yaakov chastises Yosef and says, what do you think your dream means? That I, your mother, and all your brothers are going to come and bow down to you? Obviously an implication that his mother was already passed away, so how could that be true? But he says, that you're going to be out on the ground. When you prostrate yourself, that's on the ground. Now even though the Bali Tosafot first of all point out that by Kidah it says, by Batsheva, that she fell apayim aretz, she fell on her face on the ground. So you also have aretz by kida. And they also find, so that you find that, you also found apayim, you will find the face. So then how can you differentiate between kida and ishtachavaya if by both of them it writes aretz and by both of them it writes about panim? Yishlamar, mid gemora itlan kidal apayim, umayt eshkaha nami mkra hochi. That it is a misora, the Tosafot says in the end, that is a halacha l'moshe misinai that kida is an apayim, that ishtachava is pishut yadayim v'raglayim. And the only reason they're bringing the psukim is to show you that the idea is born out in the psukim. But the psukim aren't the evidence, but rather, like almost like an asmachta, to the fact that we know this halacha from the halacha l'moshe misinai. Now, that is the way the Bali Tosafot explained it. It's not clear here how you exactly differentiate. Kriya seems to be pretty straightforward. It means you get down on your knees. The Kida and Ishtachavaya are much more difficult to understand what exactly the difference is. How is Kida done? If Kida is done by going down on your knees and then putting your face on the ground, isn't that already Kriya? And it seems to me that Kida is differentiated from Kriya. So it's possible that Kriya just means getting on your knees. Kida means you get on your knees and then you put your face and hands down on the ground. You don't stretch yourself out. You don't prostrate yourself. You simply touch your face to the ground. The Rimi Gash over here says that's not the case. He says Kida is when you're upright and you double your body over. You bow yourself down until your face touches the ground without going down on your knees. Kriya is going down on your knees. And then Ishtachavaya is prostrating oneself. So he tries to differentiate between all the three types and say that they are completely independent. Kida is just touching your face to the ground. Kriya is getting your knees on the ground. And Pishut Yadayim V'Raglayim is prostrating oneself on the ground. You could have read it, and the way that Rashi and the Bali Tosafot seem to read it is, Kriya is getting down on your knees. Kida is being on your knees and then touching your face to the ground. Mishtachalaya is pishut yadayim reglayim, is prostrating oneself flat out on the ground with your hands and legs stretched out. And that does have a possible nafkaminot as to our practices on Toshana and Yom HaKippurim when we bow down on the ground and we lay down. So the question is, what was the demand over there? And it seems to be that it's Hayu Korim Umishtachavim Umodim. So there it seems to be that there is a requirement of Ishtachavaya that would demand Pishut Yadayim Viraglayim. On the other hand, if you believe that all is being demanded over there is Kidah, Kishayu Shomim et Shemim Mifurash, they would say Mipi Kohen Gadol. And the reaction was Hayu Korim Umishtachavim Umodim.
Pinoflim Al Kanehem.
Then you would only have to have your face touch the ground and you wouldn't have to stretch yourself out. And that would have enough kamina as to how to bow in those circumstances. For instance, when we're replicating the avoda that was in the Mikdash during the Musaf of Yom HaKippurim. Okay, we're going to stop here, but the two dots on the bottom of Tetzayin Amud Bet.